I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anelio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast.
That is Patrick Hester. In addition to doing this fine podcast, he's also an author. He's got a book out. It's called Into the Fire. It's Sam Cain, book one. It just came out. It's really good. Go buy it. It's good. Go get it. My name is John Anelio. Today, we're joined by Michael Johnston. He's an author, but he studied architecture and ancient history at Lehigh University. He earned a master's degree in architecture from Columbia University. By day, he worked as an architect, but by night, he wrote and researched an epic fantasy novel inspired by the history of ancient Egypt and the tragic story of King Lear. That book is Solari. That's out from Tor, and it'll be available on June 13th. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys. I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, no problem. And we have your website is michaeljohnstonauthor.com, and your Twitter handle is mjohnstonauthor.
You got it.
All right. Very good. Well, I'm glad that we got all that going. And so is this your debut novel?
This is I'm calling it my debut novel. For me, it is truly my debut novel. It's the first novel I've ever written entirely on my own. I did co-author a YA trilogy with my wife, the author Melissa Dela Cruz, but it was really those were really her books. I don't consider them so much mine. We're a husband and wife who both write, so inevitably, being in one household, we talk and we share, and it's an idea that we both came up with, so we shared that one. But Solari was the first time I took an idea of my own and put it out there in the world.
That's I'd love to talk more about that, because we have people who have been co-authors on the show. We've even had husband and wife co-authors on the show before. It's Clay and Susan Griffith, I believe, was the husband and wife author team that we had. So I'm always fascinated by it. So I'd love to get into that in the main part of the show. But before we do that, I do want to thank the people that back us on patreon.com/functionalnerds. You make us worth doing the show. We couldn't do it without you. We're really appreciative of it. If you listen to the show every week and you dig it, you get value out of it, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now we're going to get into our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Michael, do you have a pick prepared, or do you want Patrick and I? Oh, good. Why don't you tell us
that was my part of this, right? Yeah.
Yes, you have a pick. So tell us what it is.
Like everybody else who reads and writes, I have a pile, and these books just sort of pile up beside me, and when it gets too high, it falls over. I never seem to catch up with it. But this one was the top of it. Oh wait, this is just. There's no video, right?
Yep.
Okay. So. Yep. Imaginary Cities by Darren Anderson. It's a pretty interesting book. It's kind of about architects and their visions of the world and how those visions play out when they're actually constructed. So it's a book that really interests me, because I'm someone who's interested in theoretical architecture and people who take ideas about building and the world and constructing our world, imagining the universe, and then putting it into being. Because architects are a lot like fantasy authors. We imagine worlds. We make things. We make cities and places to live in, just the way sci-fi authors build worlds. Except ours people actually have to live in. And, so there's a burden there. So he discusses a little bit of that, the imaginary and the real. Also at the top of my stack was Saga Book 2. If you read graphic novels, they just put out the second omnibus edition. And I love binge reading these things. So to get 18 episodes of Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples is a pretty incredible thing to have. So both of those are very different, but worth jumping on.
I am a big fan of Saga. I think you are too, right, Patrick?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So you're reading the omnibuses. So I would read it where it would be the, you know, I guess about five or six issues that pop.
You put the trade paperback.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading it that way for the first 18. And then I actually reread it when the first hardcover came out. And it was just so fun to binge read it. I actually forced myself to wait this whatever 18 months it was. I have not read Saga so that I could have the pleasure of binge reading this entire next set of the story. So it was it was definitely a labor. I forced myself each month not to buy it so I could have this sort of joy of, you know, getting all of them at once. So it's pretty cool.
That's a great way to go about it. And a comics related question for both of you, Michael, you first. So I don't know if you guys saw the story that DC is now going to have their comics available via the Comixology app. I think they were always there, but they're part of like their subscription service now. I don't know what your thoughts on that are, because they had it. I don't know if it's like $10 a month, and then you get a certain selection of comics. That, you know, sort of like the Netflix of comics, I suppose. But now DC, I don't know if it's all their current titles or if it's like a back, you know, a backlog of stuff. So what are your thoughts about that, Michael?
You know, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings at DC, but I don't read their stuff. I love Image Comics. I think they're doing stuff that's so visionary and brilliant. I love Dark Horse. I think all the independent studios are putting out such great stuff. Marvel and DC, I read them as a child and as a middle grade student and loved them, but they haven't captured my attention in a little while. So it's nothing earth shattering for me. I think for me, they've been telling the same story for a long time, and some people I know Marvel especially has tried to update that story. It still feels like the same story to me. I want something fresh, so I've always gone to the indies. So to me, when I see a move like that, it makes tons of sense for me because I see people who need help, you know.
Now, Patrick writes graphic novel reviews for Kirkus. Yep. So what are your thoughts on that?
I'm with Mike. I tend to not read Marvel and DC. It's Image, Dark Horse, IDW, even some Dynamite stuff.
Of course,
you know, just different things, you know, non superhero stuff.
I mean, who published Providence? I mean, that's been the most brilliant.
Wasn't that
thing
IDW?
No, Avatar.
Avatar. Okay,
yeah,
and that was that's.
I've got it here. Avatar. 12 of the most brilliant things in comic books.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because we talk about. Marvel has definitely tried to be more diverse and like change up their characters and stuff. And unfortunately what they found is that their sales have like bottomed out. And now they're even talking about going back to the quote unquote classic versions of all their characters, you know, to try to bring back readers. So, and DC, you know, 52 and the new 52 and the Rebirth stuff, it just hasn't been doing well either. And so, it's like you said, they keep telling the same stories over and over and over again, and it's just not resonating with readers.
And it's not going to. You can't. You know, I've heard that. I grew up a big Batman fan, especially Frank
Miller.
Me too.
Yeah.
You know, same thing. Just really inspired me, especially the first Dark Knight series. Brilliant stuff. And I mean, that's one title that people have put a lot of creativity into over the years, but. You know, if I see Batman get shot in the alley with those pearls cracking one more time, I'm going to tear up whatever medium it comes in.
Yeah, and you talk about Frank Miller; those were great books, but now if you kind of look back at everything he's ever done, he tells the same stories over and over and over again, which is sad.
Yeah, it's you know, hey, these are great. I feel like all those stories are great stories. They've been told, you know. Chris Claremont era X-Men, things like that. Frank Miller era Daredevil. They had their great moments in Marvel, and you know, for me, I don't see as many of those anymore. And other people are telling great stories. When you look at like Image, like you know, Low is a great book. Seven for Eternity is a great book. Saga. You see brilliant new stories out there. So.
Yeah, why bother reading the same story that you've read 100 times when you have all this? Yeah, because I think there is so much out there. So, Patrick, what is your pick this then?
Well, and I'll throw one more thing out there. When you do have someone very creative, like doing something different at Marvel or DC, and then a book takes off, inevitably Marvel and DC decide to take that person off the book, or they change some, or they say, no, you can't do that. And then it all tanks, and whatever creativity was going on dies, which is unfortunately sad.
So you get what you get for being owned by Walt Disney.
Now, I will say that, you know, I am enjoying immensely the cinematic universe and the TV shows and stuff that Marvel's doing. And my pick this week is actually the Defenders trailer for Netflix.
I saw that.
Good.
They launched that. There's very little Danny Rand in it, which is awesome. And, you know, they've started some chemistry. You know, you've got Jessica Jones is in the police precinct or something being questioned, and she's like answering questions, and then, you know, in bursts Matt Murdock, and he's like, don't answer any more questions, I'm your lawyer. They're going, woo.
I think Daredevil's been well handled by Marvel. I think that's been a great property. The other way, you know, I haven't completed all of them. I mean, they've put out so many that I haven't stuck with them, but I think they've done a great job. In fact, I prefer Daredevil to anything that they've done in the movies, in the cinematic universe. I think it's been a far more intimate and well-executed story than I've seen in a lot of their movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a totally different tone, which is great. But that's really cool. Yeah. I watched the trailer too, and boy, man, yeah, the Iron Fist, man, it really, it really put a little bit of a stain on that. They're going to really have to, the Defenders is, in my mind, really going to have to deliver, because I like forced myself through Iron Fist and was not happy by the end of that. And it looks pretty good. So. Yeah, no, I knew I knew what I was getting into. I accepted it, man. I accepted it. But anyway, my pick, we've talked about this series. This is one of my favorite authors, probably my favorite author at this point, and that's Brandon Sanderson. And I finally finished the original Mistborn trilogy. That's the Hero of Ages book. I did the audio book of that one, which is like 29 hours or something. Oh, did you finish that one too? So good. I really love Brandon, and just to, you know, I know we had him on the show a while back, and you know, he's definitely someone that really outlines and plans his world in his book, and the way that he revealed things as that book went on, I just thought was masterful. And I just walked away from that book just feeling very satisfied, surprised in some ways, and the way that he decided to go with it. But just for that many pages devoted to that story, three books, all very long, he really delivered the goods at the end.
Afraid to kill off characters.
No, not afraid. And it was just, I thought it was great. I really walked away loving that. And I'm excited to get into the second Mistborn trilogy, which I think takes place in a couple hundred years.
Yeah, it's like steampunk.
Yeah.
I've read the first two in that. I'm a fan as well. I've read the first two. I loved Mistborn, and I actually wanted to stop at that because I felt like it was a novel that was – he left some loose ends, obviously, the mists and so forth. But it was a perfect novel that on its own. I love that it kind of stood on its own and didn't demand, you know, a huge series afterwards despite the things that he left open. I love the reversal, you know, sort of Dark Lord triumphs kind of world. But you know, I've read the first two and I stopped at the third. It didn't quite grab me, but so it's interesting to hear that it actually does end, in a satisfied manner. You're going to force me to go back and read that third.
Yeah, I did. And you know, I don't know if if you do audiobooks at all, if you're just
I do everything. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I don't know where you guys are. So I'm always in the car. So I not only have a stack of physical books that I'm reading at any moment, I usually read two or three. I just skip by what grabs my attention, but I have an audiobook going at all times.
I love how the freeway down into San Diego coming out of LA is like 47 lanes. And if there's an accident in one lane, they close 46 and a half lanes and make you kind of go off onto the shoulder.
LA is a place where you spend time in your car. So, You know, really the audio, I got an Audible account, so you get a new book each month. Yep. And, you know, it just fills that time. And, you know, I don't have the road rage. I don't want to kill anybody on the road. I'm just, you know, sitting there listening to a 48, you know, hour long George R. R. Martin novel. And, you know, hey, I've got time to burn.
Yeah, that's the way I look. And I think Patrick's the same way, where it's mm-hmm. it's audio sometimes and physical books and ebooks. And, you know, to me, it's nice to have all those different formats, because you always have something available to you. You can always, you know, keep going with your reading no matter what situation you're in. And I love the audio books too. I think
audio has become huge. You know, especially with fantasy, because I don't think it's so difficult to represent fantasy on the big screen. Even Game of Thrones sometimes has budget limits that, you know, you just don't get what you want to see. Like, we never see what we want to quite see. But, you know, I think audiobooks give us this fascinating in-between where it's a performance. We hear actors, you know, even though it's usually just only one person, we hear an actor's voice and actual performance, and it really can add to and strengthen the book if you have a really strong narrator. And it gives you a different, I think, more in-depth experience or interpretation of the book.
Totally agree.
Yeah, my friend of mine who is a big audiobook listener, you know, he had texted me a couple weeks ago about whatever he was talking about. And, you know, he was saying how, you know, an average book with a great voice actor makes it a great book, and a good book with a poor voice actor makes it like a lackluster book. Sometimes it can really ruin the experience.
So, Yeah. You need a great actor.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's, and some of them are really impressive. You forget the fact that, like, oh, this is a female character, but that's a man doing that. And you totally just you buy into that world. If they're good enough, you feel like it is almost like a full cast when it is most of the time one. Sometimes it's two. With the Brandon Sanderson book,
he does get two.
Yeah, something. Yeah, for the Stormlight Archives, it's the two.
Kate Redding.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So those are awesome. Well, Michael, let's get into you and your book and your career. And, you know, you mentioned it already, but I wanted you to maybe tell us a little bit about how you know, some of the things that happened in your life where you decided that you wanted to pursue architecture and become an architect. Like, how did that love and that interest start?
Yeah, that's great, because it's also a way to lead into Slary itself, because I think Slary was really part of that journey, but it came a bit later. My interest in architecture, I was somebody who kind of wanted to be an artist, but I wasn't really sure how to go about it. I knew I didn't want to be a traditional artist, or maybe that didn't appeal to me, being a painter and so forth. But I wanted to create things. I wanted to create real things that were interesting. And so I went to school to be an engineer. So I thought, you know, really an engineer has the knowledge to create in this world, because we live in a highly technologically advanced world. Sci-fi fans, we live in a techno-advanced world. Hey, if you want to build things, be Elon Musk or someone, go to engineering school, figure out how to make things, you know, be a Steve Jobs. But I really hate, I deeply despised engineering school. it was a horrible amount of math, and it didn't seem like it was going to get me anywhere creative. Like, maybe I did need to get through, you know, a computer science degree and a mechanical engineering degree to get there. But I couldn't do it. I simply wasn't for me. So I found architecture is what I found is this sort of middle ground, I thought, between the two. And it is, in many sense, where it's not as calculation oriented. But it's more creative. So I thought you get to actually go out there and build, and, you know, you could imagine something in your head, and having an architecture degree and then working and getting licensed in the profession actually gives you the license and the ability to imagine things in your head and create them in the real world, which I think is just immensely powerful. And it's something that still excites me. I still design things and build them. We've entered a new world where now you can, I have a CNC router where I cut things, and I have a 3D printer where I make things, where I can I can imagine something, I can 3D model it in a computer, and I can make the thing. And I think that's going to change the world in ways that are so profound that we don't even know yet what the 3D printing is going to do for us. But it's going to change everything, and it already is. It's amazing. It's given our minds the ability to just think of something, model it, and make it, which I think is amazing. So that's what drew me to architecture, that ability to conceive and then make. Again, conceptually, that's what drew me to it. When I actually got out there, and I loved school because school was highly, especially Columbia University in New York, was highly theoretical. So it was simply about the notion of how do we create, how do we form ideas? What forms do we give to buildings, and why do we give them, and how do we create them, make them, and then physically bring them into being? So it was potent stuff, and I loved it. When I got into practice, and I worked for good firms in New York, firms that did creative work, firms that did work that was exhibited in museums and magazines. All of that creativity just sort of vanished, and most of what you ended up doing was, making sure the closets were deep enough so the hangers could fit. Like, you have no idea how often this is. Can I swear in this podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, you have no idea how often this is fucked up.
I do, because my grandfather was an architect.
There you go. So we fuck up that, and we fuck up toilet. there's a certain amount of space you need on either side of a toilet, and there's a certain amount of space you need in front of a toilet. And it gets you have no idea how many times people try to crowd something around a toilet in some powder room. It just gets messed up in a building. There are a million little things like that. And those are the things that occupy an architect's day. We go around making sure all those things get drawn correctly. And then when it's being built, we essentially act as nannies to contractors. And it can be a big, I had my own little firm, and I spent about 3 years on one house. And so it was 3 years of essentially nannying someone who could have just followed the drawings but didn't want to. So I found the reality of it lacked all of the creativity, and all of those things that I found were fascinating had suddenly vanished.
It became a job. Yep.
Yeah. Work, and it lacked anything that wanted to, drove me to wake up in the morning each day. Why wake up?
It's funny, where I work right now, we just did a brand refresh. And as part of that, we have brick and mortar stores all across the country, and actually in other countries as well. And they redesigned the whole layout and colors and everything. And it's hilarious because I get the 3D renders from the architects. Mm-hmm. And what's hilarious to me is what you just mentioned. In every single one of those, there is a 3D render of the restroom with the toilet, and all the space. It's in every single one of them. Yeah. And it's just hilarious to me. I get that every single time. And I'm like, should I be using that picture of the 3D render in the email? And they're like, no.
So, Michael, how do you, I imagine, because you've already sort of alluded to it, how does this manifest, how does your background in architecture manifest itself in your writing? You're talking about how you can 3D model something out and use a printer to get it. So what's the connection creatively between that and your writing?
I mean, writing is the 3D printer of the literary world. It's the thing that allows me to take anything that's in my head and put it into some kind of physical, real world form that other people can look at and interact with. And that's ultimately what I wanted to do in architecture. You want to sort of make your dreams. You want to imagine the fantastic, and you want to bring it into being. And there are a lot of great architectural firms out there that do that create these sort of things. If you're familiar with the most common architect that someone might know of is someone like Frank Gehry, say, that really really just takes his imagination and bends cardboard and brings these kind of beautiful, impossible things into being. They are worlds in themselves, and they're amazing. But, you know, that kind of work is rare in architecture, and they still, most of the people working there still are working to make certain that those toilets are correctly spaced inside each of those buildings. I guarantee you there's 30 people working on each of those buildings, and, you know, one guy gets the fun of bending the cardboard and making it look cool, and the rest are on toilet duty. So for me, I didn't want to be on toilet duty anymore. And
what's a shit job?
It is a shit. You know, literally, it is.
And it pisses you off.
Yeah, exactly. The jokes they go on. So I was tired of it. I did flushed it. You know, broken the valve, clogged the toilet. Was ready to actually do what I had set out to do originally in architecture, really, which was I liked that idea of taking things that were in my head, in my imagination, and bringing them into the world. You know, I wanted to dream, and I wanted to exist in reality. And I think narrative is a place where that can happen, and second world fantasy is a place where that can happen, where you can actually imagine a world in its entirety, in all of its complexities, and put it into a novel. And there's a lot of, aside from that, which is a very general statement, there's a lot of very specific ways in which architecture comes into my novel, Solari. I've talked a lot about kind of theoretical architecture or the architecture of ideas, and there's a lot of the history of the architecture of ideas is represented at Solari, and it's done in a very secretive kind of way that I actually think people who don't know architecture won't even know. But there's a lot of famous pieces of visionary architecture that appear in Solari and are a part of it. One piece that comes to mind is Étienne Boulay's Cenotaph for Newton, which is this fascinating structure. He believed in something they called the 18th century architecture parlante, which was talking architecture. And I bring that up because it's so relevant to being a writer. He believed that buildings could talk or say something or even tell stories through their form. So you can see he was almost thinking of architecture as a narrative device. And so in the Cenotaph, I don't know if you know what it is. It's an interesting building form. It is a tomb with no body, which is fascinating. And that means a lot in Solari, because there are a lack of bodies in this sort of city of gods. But this tomb with no bodies is essentially a dome, and it has little pricks in it. So during the day, light shines through, and it appears like a starry sky. And then inside, they light this great brazier during the day, and it appears like daytime. And so the whole point of the building was to sort of simulate a cosmos, an entire day. And people would light this brazier and then put it out during the day so that people who came to this monument could experience an entire day kind of within the structure simulated. And it's something that really fascinated me personally. And it makes sort of a guest appearance in Solari. It has has a lot of meaning for my story. But I'm not going to say why, because it gives away.
So when you're writing and devising this stuff, how much of it is you sitting down and hacking away at it? How much of it is you, you know, sort of imagining, you know, physically what's going on in the world? Like, do you go back and forth? Do you start one place? Is it just a mix and match of both ideas?
I outline heavily. You know, in word, it's a 500-page book. In reality, Tor squished it down to about 387 pages, which is sort of magic they did. I had an outline in word that was almost 200 pages long. So I plotted the whole thing out. So the sort of imaginative and research end of it went into the first part, so that when I actually got to writing, it could just focus on the craft of writing, which is entirely different than being an architect. And it's the reason why I spent 5 years on Solari and why it was such a big project for me and probably so personally important. I simply spent a long time on it because it was my first time doing it. And I think I went back and redid it and reworked it an unbelievable amount of time. I don't really admit how many edits I went through.
Would you say that outlining is where the architect and engineering skills come in, and then actually crafting the novel itself is where, you know, it pays to be like a union contractor?
Yeah, you know, that's the fascinating part. I was just asked that in a paper interview that I've been working on. The question was, you know, was exactly that. Did being an architect, or does being an architect, you know, because architects organize things for a living. Did that help you outline a book? Because you made such a big outline. Obviously, the two must be related. And you know, it's something I had to really think about. And because when I went into the process, that's exactly what I thought, that I'm going to be, you know, the master outliner, because I'm the guy who plans things. I'm an architect. And I know, and to be honest, I ended up answering the question with just sort of a flat no. Like, just utterly, you come to this point where conceptually, yeah, they're both about organization. And that's an idea. Sure, they're both about organization, but organizing a novel, plotting a novel, and plotting a building, you know, back to the toilets. It's going to be a toilet interview. It's just entirely different. There is no overlap. You know, the technicalities of architecture are entirely different than those of plotting a novel and, you know, creating an arc, moments of suspense and so forth. The way you structure a novel, build a novel, and create that experience for reader that's enjoyable, it's its own craft entirely. And it's something that I had to learn, and it took me a long time to learn and master. And it's entirely different. I wish the two were same. It would have saved me so much time. You know? If only they were the same.
Now, so you're talking so much about the vast amount of time that you put into doing this. So is Solaria, is it a standalone? Is there thoughts of more?
Solaria is a duology.
Okay.
There's two books, and I've plotted it so that they really function as one novel in two parts. And both have a satisfying ending. I think you can read Solaria and say, that's an amazing book, and be done with it. But I've left enough to intrigue you to make you want to finish that duology. And I think you will, because the second gives the story a kind of grand ending. I've just finished writing the second book, and it's amazing. It's another, I only had 18 months to write this one. So it was for me, it was a sprint, but it's done, and I love it. And it's a satisfying close. I've left enough open for a second duology, and I hope to write a second duology in the series. And there's another part of the story that is unexplored at the end of the second book. So I'm hoping to have that opportunity. We'll see if it happens.
Oh, that's great. I'm really looking forward to reading it. Yeah, it sounds great. So before we do wrap it up, so Solaria, for people listening, and yeah. So for your architecture fans and for toilet fans out in the world, but it will be available June 13th. That's when it's gonna launch, and I'm sure it's gonna be ebook. It's gonna be hardcover. Usually Tor puts them out in hardcover. Do you know anything in terms of, because we were talking about audiobooks, do you know if it's going to be as an audiobook as well?
I don't actually.
Yeah, sometimes the audiobooks come later, significantly later, so we will be on the lookout for that as well. So will you be coming up, or are you going to be doing any convention appearances?
I will be at BookCon. I'm going to be at the Barbarian Bingo on Sunday. So see me if you're going to BEA. Their sort of con day on Sunday, I'll be at Barbarian Bingo at 3 p.m. And then I'm going to repeat that. I think they're doing one. They're going to repeat it in Brooklyn a few days later. After that, we'll see. Hopefully Solaria will be at Comic-Con. So if you're there, try to look me up on the panel list.
Nice.
And after that, I'm going to do a few dates locally. We're going to do a little West Coast tour. So I'll be at Borderlands in San Francisco. I will be at the Grove in Los Angeles, and I'll be at Mysterious Galaxy down in San Diego. So there's going to be a little West Coast tour that week of June 13th. So if you live in any of those cities, follow my Twitter and I'll tell you all about the events.
Awesome. Yeah. And once again, Michael's Twitter is M Johnston Author and his website is michaeljohnstonauthor.com. I'm sure the appearances will be listed up there as well. Well, Michael, best of luck with it. It sounds great. Patrick, anything you want to mention before we get going here?
Not this week.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening. If you dig what we do, you dig these interviews, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Again, Michael, thank you for joining us, and everybody have a great week.
Thanks, guys.
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
'You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.